Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain. Support for WPR comes from Bernie's Rock Shop, sponsor of the 2024 Madison Gem and Mineral Show, November 23rd and 24th at the Exhibition Hall of the Alliant Energy Center. Details are at madisonrockclub.org.
Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with a tech update for you. We're talking about an advancement in technology called ambient computing to begin the show. It's kind of an effort to make computers, a seamless part of your life, I guess we could say. It includes inventions like AI and speech recognition. And our guest is Beth D'Angelo. She's a senior IT specialist in UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And as we talk with Beth, I hope you'll join in. Give us your thoughts on smart devices or AI. How useful are they for you? Maybe you're wondering how they work. And, of course, if you're having a problem with your phone or your computer, we'll take those kinds of questions as well as we move along. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Beth D'Angelo, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good, thinking about ambient computing. This high-tech workplaces and our homes are beginning to use ambient computing. What are they? I think they're also called invisible or ubiquitous computing. And these digital devices sort of anticipate what we want, right? And then the technology facilitates that action?
Yeah, it's a kind of a cool mixture of various technologies coming together to provide a bit more of a seamless interface where we maybe don't notice so much that we're interacting with devices or with computer in our everyday life, but these devices and computers are enhancing our experience.
Yeah. Maybe an example of a useful ambient computing device would be an alarm clock that asks, you wake up and asks you if you want coffee. And if the person says yes, the alarm clock activates the coffee maker.
Wouldn't that be great, huh? Just, those little things that can enhance our everyday experience in life where a machine or a computer can kind of take on that function for you. So I guess less things for you to have to do manually in your life and when you can tell a device to do it.
Yeah.
There's also, many instances where this technology is actually already being used that people may not actually think of or really recognize, but a lot of newer cars are coming with many of these built-in ambient technologies that enhance the experience of driving or, help add new safety measures.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. A friend of mine has a pretty new car, and driving on the road with her, and there's a little warning if she got too close to the car in front of her, or if she, somebody was passing her a little close. There, the car was recognizing that and telling her.
Yeah, using a combination of sensors and then cues for the driver. Some of these warning systems can detect if a car is in the lane next to you that may be in your blind spot that you don't see and give you a little light on your rearview mirror that tells you it's not a good time for you to change lanes.
Yeah.
Don't try to get off this exit if somebody is in your blind spot.
I don't know if this would count, but my watch and my computer, when in the morning when I'm about ready to get up, which is about 20 minutes to 6, my watch is telling me it's time for me to go on my run. And I've never told the watch to tell me that, but every morning for years, I have gone to map my run to start my morning run at about that time. And it seems to have anticipated that.
And see, that's really a big part of ambient computing and how those who are manufacturing these products are looking to integrate them into people's lives is to anticipate your preferred next move. So to really get to know the human that's using this technology and then using the built-in artificial intelligence in these products, then being able to anticipate what your preference is going to be for what to do next. So like you said, it's going to tell you to do your go take your run because it got used to that's what you do every morning at that time. So it's a nice little reminder.
Yeah, does the same thing at night. Reminds me it's time to go to bed.
Right, reminds you when to go to bed. It'd be nice to have one to remind you to, you know, take your pills or to drink water. Just these little gentle nudges during our day where we may not be mindful of what our needs are. But if we have something that's tracking our typical behavior, that can help augment that and give us those gentle reminders to continue with those healthy behaviors.
Yeah.
Then you see these technologies can be really beneficial.
I wish it could help me fall asleep right away. I mean, I can some nights.
It may be able to remind you to turn off your technology an hour before you go to bed so that you have an easier time going to sleep.
Oh, man. Jeff Robbins says, what about cruise control? Cruise control can slow down if you get too close to the car in front of you.
Yeah, it's really neat how these technologies are now hopefully, like I said, augmenting our experience rather than taking over for, you know, human judgment and us paying attention to the things that we need to pay attention to. I think just because you have a reverse camera in your car, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't check your mirrors as well. But having these safeguards in place that are technology controlled can really augment the human systems that are meant to use these devices.
Let's talk about artificial intelligence a bit more. How could artificial intelligence make ambient computing more effective?
Yeah, that's where tracking your behavior and understanding your behavioral patterns, using AI to correlate that with possible responses to that behavior, and then to give you those either answers or prompts or to take actions on your behalf based on your previous behavior, and also based on a library of behavior models that device has already learned.
But some images created by AI, we can talk about images here for a minute, they're passed off as real. And I think this has contributed to some problems.
Definitely. The deep fake world is really kind of disturbing these days with what technology enables us to do with voice recognition, the pattern recognition in facial movements and expression. The ability to recreate those using digital animation and video editing. It really is hard sometimes to tell what's real and what isn't. Thankfully, some of these same technologies can be used as detection tools as well. So to make it easier for us to figure out what is AI-generated and what is actually human-generated content.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest, questions for her. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us. The email address is talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. How could, before we take some calls here, how could ambient computing work with, what do they call it, augmented reality, AR, I guess it is, glasses?
Yeah, so that's the other side of things where right now we have a big resurgence in virtual reality and augmented reality. And both of those technologies typically need some sort of interface device like a screen or I know some folks are familiar with the Apple Vision Pro, the headsets that provide augmented reality view through a pair of glasses. What ambient technology and artificial intelligence and augmented reality come together is to provide that full experience where you can interact with the environment and then the environment can interact back with you in an automated way using these language models for artificial intelligence that kind of predict the preference of the person who's in that environment. So changing the lighting, changing the music that's around, maybe pointing out certain things that you may want to see in an environment, giving you information based on previous search history of what you would be looking for. So navigating through spaces with computer technology visible to you through an AR device or a VR device.
So, well, let's take a call from Tom in De Pere, and then I'll come back with another question. Tom, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my question is, do you think that all this augmented computing is bringing us closer to the brave new world where people forget how to do things? They forget how to do math. I mean, I see people walk out of, or I've gotten receipts at it from a cash register where they scanned everything and it's wrong. But people don't recognize that. They just simply assume that they scanned it. The computer did the right thing. People, you know, forgetting how to do read maps because it's all in our phone. We push a button or we tell our phone where we want to go and it guides us.
It's some interesting thoughts there. What do you think, Beth?
Well, I think that any time we experience a big wave of new technology coming into consumer hands, there's a similar kind of tension where is this going to dumb us down as a species where we have a computer taking over a skill that a human would normally need to master in order to navigate through the world. When GPS technology came out, like you mentioned, can people read maps anymore? Are they too dependent on their technology to get them through? And this is where I always use the trust yet verify mindset, where I will trust the machine or the system or the computer to provide me with an answer, but then I will always also use a second source to verify that. Keeping a map in your car, making sure I always keep a gazetteer and an atlas in my car just in case I don't have a signal and can't use my GPS. Always having those backup methods of being able to do something if your technology isn't available to you or isn't providing you with correct information. And especially with AI, we have this saying in technology that's garbage in, garbage out. So if the data that's going in is not correct, the data that you receive out of it is going to be skewed. So we need to be really careful what our sources of information are in order to be able to verify those facts.
Yeah. I was thinking about trying to get out of Chicago's O'Hare Airport parking lot. My computer was telling me to turn left at a particular stop. And my good friend Mike said, no, I've been in here many times and you have to turn right here. So I almost turned left, but then I thought, Mike must know. So I turned right, and he was right.
That was a good call. Always go with your instincts, right? Your gut knows probably better than Google Maps in that case.
Yeah. I was glad because it probably saved us a bit of time getting out of the airport in Chicago. You can join in. Go ahead.
Yeah, one thing that I've always kind of had a problem with since having cell phones is I don't remember anyone's phone number anymore. If I did need to call someone and my cell phone wasn't working, I would have no idea how to get in touch with them.
Yeah. True indeed. But Google Maps can also tell us if there's road construction or something to avoid that a paper map wouldn't. Somebody said.
This is augmentation, right? It's making it better.
Tom, thank you for calling. Kathleen in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I'd like to make a comment first. I think that there are very good uses for AI. None of this retail consumer stuff that you're talking about that is just silly. I would like to know, are there ways to block it on your phone? Now when I go to Google something, Meta is there. And Meta wants to tell me, you know, what I want to find, which is not usually what I want to find. I don't find it to be at all helpful.
Yeah, Kathleen, good point. Thanks for calling. Are there ways to block the use of AI on your devices?
Yeah, so there's two different things that I want to talk about as far as, you know, controlling access to your information and then controlling how the AI kind of interacts with you when you're using those programs. there are settings within, let's say you use Safari as your browser. There are settings within Safari that will allow you to shut off any of the kind of extra add-ins that are either providing information to your search. So when Meta makes suggestions for you, if you want to turn that off, there are settings in your browser that will allow you to do that. The other thing is, what information do you want those service providers to share about you so that you are then fed advertising information by others? And that's something that is now pretty controversial with some of these large language model AI platforms, where they are using our data that we put into the social media apps and other applications that we use. They use those data points, sell them to advertisers, and then advertisers use those as ways to target advertising towards you, which is another thing we need to kind of tightly control with the settings in our applications.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I bought a pan online. I paid for the pan, and that was like a year ago, and I'm still getting advertisements up that are exhorting me to buy that same pan that I bought a year ago, and I'm almost now to the point where I wish I wouldn't have even gone online and clicked on that darn pan.
Yeah, this is something that's really become controversial lately. Companies like PayPal have been sharing payment data. Now, that's not to include actual like credit card numbers or financial information about an individual, but trends in somebody's spending. That data is actually being sold to advertisers to use for targeted advertising to individuals. So even if you're not searching for the thing in Google, you know, we know that searching for something in Google is then going to end in targeted ads for you in other platforms. But if you're just paying with PayPal for something that you didn't search for, PayPal may be sharing that information if you don't have your settings adjusted to not allow that to happen.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest today, Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. We've started the show today by talking about ambient computing and AI, and certainly you can join in with questions relating to this area, or maybe you just have a question about your phone or your computer or your system or what's operating well or not so well for you at home. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mehler for WPR News. Taking a look at technology on the show today with Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at the UW-Madison Division of Information Technology. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Gail in Madison emailed to say they've been noticing that sometimes their smartphone doesn't tell them that they have voicemail. Friday morning, Gail restarted their phone and found a message for the first time that was sent 45 hours earlier. Luckily, her friend wasn't mad that I ghosted them.
Yeah, sometimes I find that happens on my iPhone as well, that a voicemail will show up later after I get another call that where the indication wasn't there and the voicemail wasn't listed previously, but then I get another call and suddenly two voicemails pop up. And sometimes this happens if the voicemail happens to come in when your phone isn't either isn't turned on or you're disconnected from a network. So let's say you're out of cell service range and the cell phone doesn't show up when you come back into range. Sometimes that won't show up until you get another call that comes through. And I found the way to kind of stop that from happening is if I know that I've been offline for a period of time, I'll go into when I come back online and either disable and then re-enable the password on my voicemail to get it to recognize. So there's a setting in the voicemail settings on your phone that lets you shut off the password and then turn it back on. That'll make the voicemail messages pop up or resync if you need to.
Hmm. Well, and Gail's final comment was a mid-20th century phone actually worked. If people didn't reach you, they called again. Oh, man. Kathy in Sun Prairie has something for us. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning. I've been having problems on an old MacBook Air laptop accessing my email. It continues to stop pulling new messages. And I'm wondering, because I think I bought the thing back in 2013, like if the operating system is maybe just too old to support the email that and I have an MSN email, so I don't know if that's the problem as well.
Yeah, it's possible that, so on an older MacBook, the version of the operating system that you're using and the version of the whatever program you're using to pull your email down with, probably the Apple Mail program, may no longer be compatible with the MSN mail service. It may be using a protocol that is too old for the mail service to deliver to. So likely the best course of action is to upgrade the operating system on that MacBook. That will actually upgrade the version of Apple Mail that you're using and likely give you the latest protocol that will then allow you to connect back to MSN to deliver your mail back to your mailbox. Some of those older mail protocols have been sunset by mail providers because they weren't as secure. Sometimes the older systems don't have a new enough version in order to access those.
And Kathy or somebody else might wondering, well, how do I do that?
Well, updating the operating system, it depends on the type of machine you have. If you have a Windows operating system, it's best to reach out to Microsoft through their support pages and go through their documentation on how to upgrade from the version that you have to the latest version and whether or not that'll work with the type of machine you're using. For an Apple computer, in the settings, there is an iOS update that you can go into that will walk you through step-by-step on how to do that update. And it'll only allow you to update to the latest version that your hardware will support.
Okay, so in Kathy's case, there might be an update that'll work, at least for now.
It's possible. I would also maybe check with MSN with their mail service to see what is the earliest version of the Mac iOS or the Mac Apple Mail program that is permitted.
That makes sense. Kathy, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Patrick and Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. So I've got a 2023 new car, and when I go to the drive-through and make my order, and then I proceed to the window to pay for it, I take my seatbelt off because I got to get my debit card out, and the car turns the radio off. It's punishing me for what it perceives as bad behavior. And I've also had my smart car. I'll be following a car, and it will get into a turn lane, you know, turn a turn signal on, and get into the turn lane. And my car slams on the brakes because it thinks the car is still ahead of me, when in fact it's in another lane. So some of this technology is wonderfully helpful, and some of it is incredibly frustrating and has the potential to really go bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. I think you're right. With some of these technologies, they are maybe not quite refined enough to operate the same way a human being would, and especially with something like your car slamming on the brakes because it's anticipating a car in front of it when it's not. That's a really scary scenario, and in that case, I would look into the manufacturer's recommendations for turning something like that off.
Yeah, you got a new car there. I'd go back to the Subaru dealer and say, hey, look, what's going on here? What's going on here? And undoubtedly, there would have been other people that have had the same problem.
Yeah, I would hope that if anything like that was coming up regularly, that they would issue some sort of a recall notice or, you know, if it was a known issue, that they would let people know.
Yeah. Robert in Sun Prairie, we'll go to you now. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
My question is about DuckDuckGo and whether it shares search history or not by default, or they claim to not share search history, but I'm just wondering if that's settings or if they do that by default.
Yeah, actually, DuckDuckGo, they don't track your search history, and that's by default. There's nothing that you need to change from the default settings to get that to work.
Yeah. And Robert, you had a follow-up?
I do. The Raspberry Pi has a software for Pi-hole that redirects adware. And I'm wondering if that's something that you recommend. I know ad blocker, if you have the ad blocker in your browser, then the website host knows that you're using ad blocker and withholds content. But the Pi-hole claims to redirect the ads so that the server doesn't know that you're using an ad blocker.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Pi-hole works at the edge rather than at the device level. So it's kind of an intermediate device that blocks ads by putting them into what they call a DNS sinkhole. So essentially, the website doesn't know that you are trying to block those ads, so it's not going to screen any content from you for doing that. So it's kind of a way to trick those websites that are not serving full content if someone isn't accepting those ads into serving the full content without having to see those ads.
Yeah. Robert, does that help?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it has to be running on your home network somewhere is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, that's correct. It's like an in-between piece of hardware that you attach to your router and then from there into your Wi-Fi system. So it would go in between, I would say, your internet modem, your cable modem, and your Wi-Fi router.
Yeah. Robert, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Samantha in Whitehall called to say something keeps her computer messages. She keeps getting computer messages saying that her computer is infected. She gets pop-ups. And she can't get rid of the pop-ups.
Yeah, that sounds like malware to me. Probably not a virus, but likely something called malware, which is, you know, similarly intrusive, but sometimes not necessarily as destructive. Generally, what I recommend is downloading a program called Malwarebytes, and that's all one word. And Bytes is spelled with B-Y-T-E-S. It's a free program. You can download, scan your system. It'll find any malware that's been installed and ask you if you want to remove it, and then it'll go through the removal process for you. Really helpful piece of software.
Yeah. If your device no longer accepts the latest software updates, as in that earlier caller, is this basically time to get a new device?
It depends on what you're doing with it. If it's, you know, a device that you're not doing your banking or putting much personal information into, maybe it's something that you're just, you know, maybe it's an old tablet that you just use for watching Netflix. That's not something that you really need to worry about updating. As long as your network is secure at home, you've got, you know, a network firewall and a secure router. But if it's something that you're going to be doing any kind of personal information sharing, if any of your banking is going to be done on there, your health information is going to be transmitted through it, I would definitely recommend replacing it with a newer piece of hardware that can receive security updates regularly.
Yeah, that makes sense. We've talked about it, I think, through calls. There's been a downside or two as we look to more ambient computing. From your mind, what are the biggest possible downsides as we move to more ambient computing?
Well, I think some of the things that people have discussed already, you know, as we become more and more dependent on technology to do some of the normal things that we would do for ourselves, are we going to lose kind of the ability to do those things? Are we going to lose those skills? You know, are we concerned about that information becoming data points that can be sold to advertisers to use for targeted advertising that we don't want to see? And then some of this technology, if it falls into kind of the wrong hands, could potentially be used against folks in a way that they don't want it to be. So I think we need to be careful with governance and regulations around how some of the ambient technology can be used and what data it can collect.
I was thinking about what they call synthetic media. Maybe talk about what it is and what are some potential issues.
Yeah, so synthetic media is a term we're giving to AI-generated media, whether that be video, photos, artwork, audio, anything of that type. Like we talked about earlier, Larry, it's getting harder and harder to discern what is AI-generated and what is actually created by a human being. So I think one thing we need to do is really invest in technologies that allow us to spot those types of deepfakes, that AI-generated content. I think platforms that that give this type of content an audience need to be really wary about how they're intaking content, how they are reviewing it, and then what the process is to vet something as to how it's been produced. So looking for those inaccuracies or, you know, minor defects in what is AI-generated to identify it and to mark it some way so that people know when they're looking at something what created it.
Yeah, I was thinking of the robocall that used President Biden's voice to discourage voting during the primary. And I think there were, after the hurricanes, there were some fake AI images that complicated disaster responses efforts.
This is correct. That's where some of these technologies falling into the hands of people that want to use them in nefarious ways reinforces the fact that you need to vet your sources. Know where your information is coming from. Don't believe everything you see. Don't believe everything you read. And be careful where that information is coming from and look for multiple sources to back up what's being conveyed to you as fact.
Yeah, for sure. Helen in Littleshute has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Helen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got kind of a strange question. My sister and I, she lives in New York City, and we usually speak once a day about family matters, even though I'm in Wisconsin. I have a Samsung S24 Ultra. She has the newest Apple that was just released. I cannot call her. When I try to call my sister, it comes up, the party you're trying to call is unavailable. It doesn't even ring. It goes to voice message. She doesn't even get my voice messages, and I can't text her as well. She asked the experts at Apple in New York City, they call it the Genius Bar. They can't figure out what the problem is. And, you know, I mean, this has been going on since last March. So now if I want to get in touch with my sister, I have to send a text to her fiance and ask him to send a text to her. And then she calls me. She can call me, but I can't call her. So that's my question. I've never had this before.
A couple of questions before I answer. Are you able to call anyone else with an iPhone?
I am, and there's no problem.
You're not able to call with your phone, but she's able to call you.
Correct.
That's interesting. I've never heard of that. My first guess is that there may be some sort of problem with your SIM card, and maybe replacing the SIM card in your phone would clear out any kind of issue that like a specific number is having with connecting to your phone. Other than that, boy, if they can't resolve it at the manufacturer or the service provider, I don't know what would be causing it.
Yeah.
Other than maybe trying, I mean, this is a workaround would be downloading something like WhatsApp, which is a separate application that you can call through. Rather than using the actual cell phone provider, it just uses Wi-Fi for calling. So that may be a workaround until your phone provider can help you figure out what's going on.
Yeah. And there's no way it would have been on her, the other end, Helen's sister's end?
You know, it could be on either side. It could be the SIM card having, you know, trouble on one side or the other. It's really hard to tell without playing around with both phones and seeing what I could figure out, you know, troubleshooting hands-on. But to me, it sounds like some sort of a SIM card issue.
Okay. Helen, does that help?
That does, because I would never guess a SIM card, because we've tried to use Facebook chats to communicate a little bit. It's just not as good as a regular phone call. But anyway, I appreciate that. I'll try that. Could it also be Spectrum, my carrier?
If you're on your Wi-Fi when you're calling, possibly. To check to see if that's part of the issue, you can turn Wi-Fi calling off in the settings on your phone to have it forced go through the cell carrier rather than your Wi-Fi.
Oh, yeah. Be another way to try it out, for sure. Helen, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Sam in Madison emailed to say AI is generating a huge energy and resource demand, from a million square foot data centers to Microsoft reopening Three Mile Island to the rare earth minerals required for microchips being mined in the Congo. This is a huge environmental problem. How can we justify the environmental destruction from AI?
Yeah, that is a big ethical question right now, because the amount of computing that's required to manage large language models, AI intelligence, ChatGPT, things like that, is really astronomical. And, you know, my hope is that, and this may sound a little bit meta, but can we use some of this AI to help us think through some possible solutions to, you know, the problems that we're creating with these technologies. This intelligence that we've created, can we harness that intelligence to solve some of our resource issues? And I think that's in academic spaces, some of those technologies are being used in that way. But right now, it's not a sustainable, way of doing things.
Yeah. Nick and Wausau.
Finite resources.
Yeah. Nick in Wausau has a question or a comment. Nick, hello.
Hi. I just had a comment about the person who couldn't call one particular iPhone. I have AT&T, and I don't know if I just didn't catch which service they have, but I had AT&T, and I'm on it's a very off phone, but it's an Android system, a little bit older. And I could call about half the iPhones in my phone book, and all of a sudden I couldn't call the other half. And this was a problem that persisted for me, it was only about 3 weeks, but I had everyone look into their side, and it ended up being that I replaced my SIM card and I restarted mine and I reinstalled a bunch of software, wiped a bunch of things out, and all of a sudden I could communicate with everyone fine. So I determined that it was on my side, and I just wanted to share that.
And Nick, thank you very much for calling. Well, there you go.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, that kind of verifies that I'm thinking it was a SIM card issue.
Yeah, and one other alternative, John in Appleton called to suggest the last caller's sister may have inadvertently blocked her.
Oh, yeah, that's possible.
That's another thing to check on, by some strange, you know, whatever, the sister may have inadvertently blocked her sister from calling her. So there you go.
Right. Yeah. I would take a look at the contact in her phone to see if she's on the blocked callers list. That would be a really simple explanation for sure.
Yeah. And Joe in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Sure. I was just wondering if in the near future, if current regulations regarding what kind of data can be collected on people and how that data could be used or sold or shared or anything like that, if those sorts of regulations get lifted or get changed or the bolts around them get loosened and the regulators have less power, all this stuff, what are some like basic privacy things that people could do on their own? Like my Samsung comes pre-installed with all sorts of Google apps, and I know Apple phones do too. I just don't know, like, how do you get away from all that?
Concern coming up if our regulations are loosened around data collection, data sharing, data sales, you know, what data points can be collected by our devices. I think, number one, when you do buy a new device, removing any apps from the device that you don't think you're going to be using. So if there are, you know, if Google's automatically on there and you don't want Google on it, I would take that off the device. If you're buying a laptop that's come preloaded with a bunch of like trial software, I would remove any of that trial software that's loaded. And then as far as like hardening your environment to make sure that some of the data privacy standards are upheld, your home network, making sure that you're using a firewall, using a browser that doesn't share data, so Safari and Firefox both don't utilize cookies, so they're collecting far less data about what you're browsing online. And then making sure that your operating system is up to date, you have the latest security patches installed, and again, vetting your sources of information. Those are really some common sense things we can do to protect ourselves.
Yeah, all good points. Beth D'Angelo, our guest today, as we talk technology with her. And I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. Thanks for joining in today as we take a look at technology issues with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist. At 12:30 today, we'll look at research that is using trees to make pain relievers. That's at 12:30, but right now it's technology on our minds. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Victor in Janesville, we'll go to you now. Hi, Victor.
Hi, Larry. I got a question. I have a Windows 11. And I use a speech feature on the computer, and I've been getting an error message, speech recognition error message 2001, and I don't know how to handle that.
So it just says error message and doesn't give you any more information?
No, it doesn't. It says speech recognition error code 2001.
Okay. Beth?
Yeah, so I haven't encountered that same issue with the speech recognition software on Microsoft, and it looks like there are some, just doing some searching right now on Microsoft's website so that it can see if that's a known issue that they can provide some guidance for. It looks like they're suggesting that it may be that your device for speech isn't selected for the program. So if you go into the settings under your start menu and you go to the sound settings under system, there's an input selection where you can choose the device that your computer needs to use for recording or for you to speak into. So check to make sure that you've got a device chosen there and that it's the correct device connected to your computer, your microphone.
Ah, all right. There you go, Victor. Thank you for calling. Sue emailed to say that they and their daughter both have iPhones. Sue can text their daughter, but if Sue calls her, it never rings. The call ends abruptly. Sue says their daughter can see that she tried to call her, but the phone doesn't ring.
Huh. Well, that may be another SIM card issue. That's really strange that the phone doesn't ring, but she can see that the call came in, but it doesn't ring on either side. I'm wondering if this is a call going from Wi-Fi or if it's a call on the cellular network, because that would really change my answer one way or the other.
Yeah, Lori emailed to say they have the same problem of two phones not accepting calls from one another. The fix for Lori and their daughter was to delete each other as a contact and then enter fresh contacts.
Huh. I suppose that could work. The only other thing is, there could be some kind of corruption in the phone book that would require that to happen. There could be, if someone's do not disturb is turned on, but it wouldn't only block one number, it would block anyone. Yeah, I think checking to make sure that that person isn't blocked on either side, like the first caller, that's a really strange issue. I'm perplexed. I'm going to do some Googling when we're done today.
Yeah, well, the business of deleting each other as a contact and then entering probably the same information, but entering it as a fresh contact.
Right. So it may be like, you know, if the contact wasn't set up properly, or if there was some issue with the application that the phone application where the contact wasn't dialing properly. And if you delete that contact and create a new one with the phone number, it'll work. Sometimes I've had it where I need to put a one in the phone number instead of just the area code. So you may want to try that. That is really strange, though, when it's only certain numbers that don't work.
Yeah. Dale in De Pere, we'll go to you. Hi, Dale.
Hi, Larry and Beth. My question is, on some higher security sites that I've been on lately that want a multi-step verification, and I think the most recent one was Social Security, they ask you to set up and insert a pass key, and I have no idea what this is.
Yeah, so if they're a pass key is a different type of, it's passwordless authentication, essentially. It's a more secure alternative to passwords. So it lets you sign in with either like a fingerprint or a facial scan or some other method for signing in other than just a username and a password. So like a lot of folks are using iPhones now that have facial recognition in them, and you can set it up so that that facial recognition will be used to sign into other applications on the cell phone. So like I have it set up where my banking application uses the passkey of my facial recognition rather than my username and password.
Yeah, I have the same thing on mine. So there you go. Does that help, Dale?
It does. I thought maybe it was like a physical device that I had to insert, like a stick of some sort to have a password on it. But okay, I understand what you're saying.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Tim in Chippewa Falls emailed to ask, what is singularity and as it pertains to AI? Singularity.
Sorry, I was on mute there. So singularity, it's a theoretical concept. So it's essentially where AI surpasses human intelligence and can improve upon itself without human intervention. So as AI gets smarter and smarter and smarter, there's this theory that it will reach a point where AI surpasses human intelligence. And when that happens, then humans actually lose control over the technology that they've created. So I don't know if you remember the Terminator movies. I think that was a central theme in the Terminator movies.
Oh, well, hopefully we're not close to that.
I hope so. I mean, in some ways, I think our AI is smarter than us in that it can probably calculate a whole lot faster than a human brain can. But as far as reaching a point where it can innovate upon itself without human intervention, I'm not sure how far out that is.
Well, let's hope that it's a long ways off.
Yeah, there are different camps on it. Some think it's a possible, real, genuine danger in the future, and others think it's really science fiction.
Let's hope it's science fiction. I'm on that side. I'm on that side. Beth D'Angelo, our guest today, senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Talking about technology on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. So maybe your computer is giving you problems. Maybe it's not downloading the latest software update, or perhaps it's caught a bug. Beth can help out. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And we had Dave in Shorewood email to share a link to a web resource for maintaining personal data security to help you maintain your First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights while attending a political protest. The address is ssd.eff.org. So ssd.eff.org. For quick reference, they've created a handy guide designed to be printed or folded and carried in your pocket. And wanting citizens to be able to hold on to this and hold those in power accountable and inspire others through the act of protest. So there, that's from Dave in Shorewood. Lynn in Waukesha emailed, they and their husband's phone prints to a Wi-Fi HP printer, but Lynn's doesn't. They both have T-Mobile phones and T-Mobile internet. Lynn's phone says the printer is not available, but the printer is on and shows it is Wi-Fi connected. What the heck's going on?
First, I would think that the phone that you're trying to print from may not be connected to the Wi-Fi network, because in order to print over Wi-Fi, both devices have to be connected to the same Wi-Fi network. So that's kind of the first thing I would check. The second thing I would check is if the printer requires an app to be installed on it to print to your Wi-Fi printer. It may be that your husband's phone has that app installed and yours doesn't. And that may be something that you can download to enable the printing feature through Wi-Fi.
All right. Craig in Stevens Point emailed to ask you to address the issue with so many computers, machines that are supposedly not able to run Windows 11. Are people going to have to purchase new machines every time there's a new Windows operating system? What do you think?
Sorry about that. I was on mute again. generally, it's not every operating system that's going to require you to buy a new device to be compatible, but more than two or three OS versions back. The computer you're on right now is a Windows 7 machine. Likely, you're not going to be able to upgrade that to Windows 11. You'll need something newer in order to use that more current operating system. I generally wouldn't rely on something more than 6 or 7 years old to be compatible with a new OS.
AI-generated content has been banned by some major photography platforms, also by some academic conferences, and certainly by some publishers as well. Why is that, and how important is it that we restrict the use of AI content?
Well, I think it's critical in certain circumstances. So here's a good example. Right now, if you were to do a Google image search for a baby peacock, most of the hits that you'll get coming up first are actually of an AI-generated image of a baby peacock that looks nothing like the real version. And if people start searching for things and expecting that the returns that they get are going to show them factual information, I think people will start to develop a very warped view of what reality actually is. So platforms that are typically thought of as a source of truth need to be taken more with a grain of salt or with a more critical eye. And there are some platforms out there that want to make sure that the content that they are serving up to people is not AI generated, specifically Shutterfly is doing that, and certain image websites where people use for stock images, they are not allowing AI-generated content.
Yeah, that makes sense. I read a piece as well on, I'm trying to remember the magazine, but they were complaining that the AI-generated stories or short novels or novellas are flooding their systems, and they're really looking for individually generated novels, individually written novels, not ones that have been put together in an hour or two and AI generated.
Yeah, that's a big problem now. Publishing platforms, you know, folks are using large language models and AI to generate content to submit for publishing to sites that are looking for story content. And it's become very difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff. So when these sites are used to submissions in the hundreds per day or in the tens per day, and suddenly they're receiving thousands of submissions per day, the vast majority of which are generated by AI, it really gums up the works as they're trying to sort through these, you know, submitted content to find what they actually want to publish for the public. So it is actually creating some big issues for content providers.
And then another way to look at it is AI a tool that increases creativity, or does it stifle and steal the creativity of real people?
I think both. You know, when used in the proper way, AI can be a very powerful tool for people to generate draft images to use for a composition tool. Let's say if we're talking visual arts, as a visual artist myself, I use AI to generate images to use for reference when I'm creating a fine art piece. So if I'm going to draw something and I want to visualize it before I set pen to paper, sometimes I'll use an AI tool to generate a reference image for me to use to then create a piece from. So I think in those types of scenarios, it can really increase or enhance creativity, whereas in some scenarios, it can kind of squash creativity when people are using it instead of their own creative mind.
Yeah, and I think, well, think about businesses. You can use synthetic media to improve maybe training for your workforce.
Absolutely. You say you wanted to generate some training videos for a new tool that you're launching for your office to use. Plugging in some specific information into an AI generation, to a generative AI tool to create maybe a video assistant or a step-by-step walkthrough on how to use a tool for a specific task. I think that's a place where we could save a lot of time in having to kind of generate some of those more mundane day-to-day tasks.
Yeah, for sure. Kate emailed to say they have hundreds of folders in Mac Mail. They used to be alphabetized upon creation, but Kate can't get them to do that now. And as a result, Kate says she's wasting her time searching for folders. Any suggestions for other than dragging the folders into order? It's interesting.
Sorry, there is actually a setting in your preferences that allows you to set up how those folders are listed. So if you go into the preferences under the advanced tab, you can go in and set it up so that your folders will then resync in you want to set the view by or the sort by to name or alphabetical order or sort order. And that'll allow you to reorder those folders in alphabetical.
Okay. Is there an email server that you recommend? The writer says parents still use AOL, but they have issues receiving and sending email through the mail app on their phone and have to go into the AOL app, which is less convenient.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend Gmail. I've been using Gmail for more than 20 years now. It is my preferred personal mail service. It's about the most secure and easiest to use mail platform for personal email use that I've found. So I would highly recommend it.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest. Questions for her? Is something going on with your computer or your phone? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We've talked about this a bit, but there's some worries that companies like PayPal and LinkedIn and Meta AI are sharing data with advertisers. And there are also reports that companies are using what people post on the internet to train AI tools. How worried should we be that companies are abusing our personal data?
I think worried enough that I would take a look at the settings of every application that I use on my devices to see what data is being stored, to see what data is being shared, to see if there are settings that you can change to limit the amount of data that's collected, where it's shared. It certainly is concerning enough to be certain that you're not sharing anything that you don't want to be sharing. And all of the apps and tools that we use, they all have preferences settings or security settings that you can take a look at. If you don't understand what the settings do, taking a look at, searching in Google for that specific application and security changes. The website that was mentioned earlier by another caller from the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, really has some great no-nonsense guides on how to ensure your data privacy is as secure as possible.
Yeah, so, and I'm going to go back to that because...
ssd.eff.org.
ssd.eff.org. There we go. You can join in, too. Again, the number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. What kinds of questions are you getting these days from the folks that you have to work with? You work with both students and staff and faculty, do you not?
Yes, I do. I work all the way across the board with technology at the university, so we get questions from all kinds of folks. I think, the hot topic right now at the university, which it's kind of ubiquitous all over, is AI. How do we use it? How do we make best use of it? How do we ensure that it is secure, that it's not using data that we don't want it to use for building language models? How do we point the correct data at it so that we don't have a garbage in, garbage out situation. But right now we're really focused on how do we deliver AI tools to campus in a way that is safe and secure, that integrates with the other technology platforms that we use to provide enhancements to the services we already deliver.
And there's no shortage of calls, I bet.
No, we're always busy. Job security.
Okay. Oh my goodness. Well, let me give that number once more. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. Where would you recommend someone start if they want to set up smart devices in their homes? Email. What's a good place to start?
So smart devices in your home. It really kind of depends on what you want to be able to do with your devices. If you're just looking to control things like your thermostat, maybe your lighting, the security on your doors, there are several platforms out there that have kind of all-in-one kits that cover those things that integrate well with each other. What I would kind of stay away from is mixing manufacturers. If you're trying to integrate multiple different tasks within your home that require different devices, trying to stick with one manufacturer is really going to help you when you're trying to integrate those things together. Because one thing that isn't really happening right now is standardization across the board of these devices so that they use the same protocols and interface methods so that they can all talk to each other across brands.
Wendy in Madison has a question for you. Wendy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to be purchasing a Mac Mini, and I'm going to need a monitor. And I want to get a monitor with speakers. And I'm just going to be using it for email and research and games, so just pretty basic stuff. So I was wondering if you could recommend a monitor that has speakers that is around a couple $100s.
Yeah, so I think probably the best option would be to stay away from the Apple manufactured monitors. Those are going to be exorbitantly expensive and probably provide quite a bit more features than you're going to need. So like the Apple Studio display, or any of their Apple manufacturers, like the Ultra Wide, those are going to be overkill for you. I know Acer is making some really decent monitors these days. The Acer Nitro is a nice, moderately priced option that has built-in speakers. It works well with the Macintosh platform. Dell is also making some very nice monitors right now that come with built-in speakers. As far as the budget side goes, there is one manufactured by a company called AOC right now that's pretty low priced that would provide all of the various features that you're looking for. There's a few different manufacturers that you can go to.
All right. There you go, Wendy. Thank you. Linda in McFarland, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I got an email that said my Google Mail was 98% full, and I either had to buy some more storage or I had to clean it up, which I don't know how to do. I had to get rid of something. And I wondered if this email was fake or real or something I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, so really important to check the source of the email. First thing you're going to want to do is go into that email and click on the email address that it came from and make sure it came from a legitimate email address from google.com. If it's from anywhere else other than google.com, I would think it's probably a spam message, and I wouldn't worry about it. The other thing you can do, if there are any links in the email, you can roll your mouse over those links, and in the bottom left-hand corner of your browser window, it'll show you the address that those links are going to go to. And if it's going anywhere than google.com, I would think that's probably a spam message as well. But if you are out of space legitimately, which happens, you do have a finite amount of storage space available in a free Gmail account. You can pay for extra storage if that's something you want to do. Or if you go through and clean out your Google Photos and your Gmail, delete emails that you no longer need, or delete large attachments from emails that you don't no longer need to keep, or download those to your computer and then delete them from Gmail. That should free up space for you.
Linda, there you go. Thank you for calling.
Also, make sure you empty your deleted items folder. That'll clear out the space. That's the last thing you want to make sure you do.
All right, Linda, thank you for calling. Mike in Janesville, we go to you now. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I have a S21 Ultra, and after the 6.1 update for the software, my touchscreen no longer works. This is all over the internet. Other people have the same issue. I called Samsung. They said they were going to fix it, and then they backed out. It's been like this for months. So I don't know. Have you heard of this? Is there anything I can do?
Yeah, this is a known issue that Samsung is dealing with, and it looks like there are two options that they've got. that they're recommending to people. One is to replace the screen on your phone, which I'm sure you don't want to pay for. And the other is to basically you downgrade it. So you install the old 6.0 version of the firmware rather than the 6.1, but likely you will need to take it into somebody to have that done for you. So either way, it's going to cost something. It may be worth it to replace the phone at this point if you don't want to put money into replacing the screen or having it fixed. But unfortunately, this is a known issue from Samsung, and they are not it doesn't look like they're providing any support to help with it.
Mm, too bad. Mike, thank you for calling. Gay called to say they lost their Yahoo password and were unable to make a new one a few years back. They'd love to get back into the old Yahoo account. Any ideas?
It's possible you may be able to contact Yahoo support to see if there's a way that they can verify your identity to reset your password for you. They have this thing called Sign-In Helper through Yahoo that does give you instructions for resetting your password using their customer support. So it looks like they do have another way of verifying identity through a code they may be able to send to your phone or verifying some account information.
And Martha in Cross Plains emailed to say Martha's using Google Maps for directions with an iPhone in her car, and the voice activation sometimes stops working. Do I need to reset something to activate the voice again?
It's possible that like the Apple CarPlay app has crashed and stopped working, and it needs to reconnect in order for it to start working again. I've had that issue using the CarPlay feature. You may want to check your Apple CarPlay settings to make sure it's set up properly to attach to your car. Other than that, maybe updating the Google Maps application on your phone to a newer version may stop it from crashing and causing that to happen.
How do you do that?
That you just go into the apps, the application on your iPhone that allows you to download apps. You would search for Google Maps, and then it'll pull up the app to download, and it'll give you an update button. Hit that update button, it'll download and install it for you.
And on that note, we are out of time. Beth, it's been, we've answered a lot of questions here and gone through a lot of things. I thank you so much for taking time to be with us, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's great to talk to you today.
Beth DeAngelo, Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Coming up, we're going to talk about the relationship between acetaminophen and trees. I'm Larry Mueller. University of Wisconsin-Madison scientists have found a way to make the pain relief medicine acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol. They make it from trees instead of from petroleum. It's cost-effective, environmentally sustainable, and commercial licensing of the method could create, some new industries, maybe into the billions of dollars. Larry Mueller here, and the leading researcher joins us today on the show, Steve Carlin, staff scientist at UW-Madison's Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Talked many times over the years about the GLBRC, and it's great to have Steve in for the first time. His research is focused on converting plant biomass to commodity chemicals and liquid fuels. And as we talk with Stephen, I hope you'll join in, want to hear from you. Did you know that the acetaminophen that you take for your headache is made from coal tar and petroleum, basically? If the same medicine was made from plants, maybe that's a better way to buy and use it. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. And Stephen Garland, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Larry. Appreciate being here.
Well, 5 years ago, you and UW-Madison biochemistry professor John Ralph discovered how to make acetaminophen from poplar trees. And I'm wondering, what the heck made you think that could be done?
Well, at the time, we were working on ammonia treatment of biomass. Kind of the poet plant over in Iowa was doing this on corn stover, and we had some researchers in Minnesota, in Michigan, that were really focused on that kind of technology. And our microbiologists were complaining about some of the inhibitors that kill their bugs. One of them would be parahydroxybenzamide. And as an undergrad, I had a reaction that was really cool to do a rearrangement. And pretty soon, a postdoc, Justin Mobley, realized that could become acetaminophen. And so we did a nice three-step process that could make acetaminophen from poplar trees.
In layman's term, what's the process?
So basically, we take ammonia, like you would buy for your wash machine, you know, to clean up a little bit. And we cook the poplar wood with that. We separate the water from it. And then that water has parahydroxybenzamide, which we can treat with bleach, just like your common household bleach. Don't mix the bleach and ammonia, though. And that makes a chemical that is one step away from becoming paracetamol, which we add in a derivative of household vinegar. So acetic anhydride is the chemical, and that makes paracetamol.
So it's kind of a lot of it then comes from what we normally have in our house.
Yeah, that was one of the goals, is we wanted to use every step something that would be very common, very non-toxic if we mixed them all together and made products that we could actually really consciously try to minimize environmental impact.
So doesn't sound like too hard of a process, but how easy and how cost-effective is this process to replicate?
Well, that was original idea, was doing this as just like in a stovetop, mixing them together. And it turns out that the product we made was not stable. And so we had a lot of trouble getting our yields up. And then we had a member of our team join us, Dr. Janin Shenar. She's a chemical engineer. And she said, why are you doing it a batch? Make this continuous. And so by making it a continuous process, we made our reaction time less than a minute. And we're able to get the yields way up. So there's a little bit of technical knowledge on how to temporally, by time, control it. But it's really fairly straightforward.
So a and what do you mean by continuous process?
Basically, like when you turn your hose on outside and the water starts flowing, that water, we're then going to put little T's where we mix things together. And that's going to continuously make something.
Oh, okay. So you're kind of shooting it in as you go along. Well, here we have, what has it been? More than a century, I think, that acetaminophen has been used made from petroleum products. That's a long time. I'm wondering even how they hit on that to begin with. But what are the advantages of making it from trees?
The biggest advantage we see is that we're not pumping out of the ground. We're not taking non-renewable sources. We're getting our products from a renewable feedstock like poplar trees. And ideally, we're viewing this as a way to actually add to the poplar pulp mill. When they're pulping and making paper or other products, we can now take what's currently going to be a waste stream that's going to get burnt and have to be detoxified and create value from it, and not have to go back to the petrochemical. So building that bioeconomy that we talk about.
Well, so this is normally a waste product then?
It would be there in the mixture of waste products. Yeah, the black liquor or some other type of stream.
And I know that just from my own background of being on this show for a long time, that poplars are trees that grow really quickly.
They do, really fast. 3 years, you can have a nice 20-plus foot tree.
And so why is it taking so long to develop this alternative to using fossil fuels to make medicine?
There are some routes. I think it's a lot of it's technical and economic. So the feedstocks for the petrochemical industry are just so cheap, it's hard to compete with. And if you don't care about the environmental impacts, then you're not taking that factor into account.
Oh, okay. But this is a cheaper way to do it.
Not sure yet. We're gonna we're still working on figuring out the economics of it, but that's going to be cost directly is one thing. But if you actually look at the whole system, where are you getting it from? What are those processes? What would be done alternatively with the stuff? It becomes an integrative problem.
Steve Carlin, our guest today. Stephen Carlin, a staff scientist at UW-Madison Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. We're talking with him about producing acetaminophen from poplar trees. It's really a fascinating discovery here, and I'm really glad that he's with us today to talk about it. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm wondering if you can make acetaminophen from this, are there other products that could be made maybe using sort of the same process?
Yeah, there's a large portfolio of material properties or products that you could make. One of the intermediates in the pathway is paraaminophenol, which is the precursor to a lot of black ink or plastics and other stuff. And so it's actually a huge market for that chemical on its own.
So this would be, I mean, could this be done at the same time you're making the acetaminophen?
It would be instead of the acetaminophen. So you use that to make acetaminophen. But there's other products we could target as well. It's a huge portfolio of chemicals.
So I'm trying to think of a way to put this. How big a tree would you need to produce a bottle of acetaminophen or Tylenol, basically, is what we're dealing with here.
I don't have that number off the top of my head. The paracetamol, basically 1% of the biomass of the wood, would be able to go into our process. So if you have a tree, which is about a ton, 1%, what would that be? 10 kilograms.
Okay.
So that could produce a decent amount.
All right. Matt in Middleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Matt, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello. I wonder if the fact that willow bark was used by the Native Americans, and it's been used since the time of Hippocrates as a pain reliever because it's got salicin in it, and it's converted to salicylic acid in the body, which most people know of as aspirin. And I found it really interesting that now we have another pain reliever also being derived from trees. Did that factor into the researchers' methodology at all?
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Matt.
So actually, willow is really closely related to poplar, and you can make the paracetamol from willow as well. Different parts of the tissue, but it was inspirational, but not really where we were going with originally.
So. Okay, but at least it was inspiring to know that it had already been done for a long, long time by Native Americans.
Very much so, and really exciting and interesting that we could potentially from willow trees make both acetaminophen and aspirin.
And willows are pretty fast growing too.
Very fast.
Very fast growing. Matt, thanks a lot. I appreciate that call. Alan in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Alan.
Hello. Fascinating show, and thanks very much.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I wondered, in that process that you just described, is it possible to make this concoction without using bleach? Because I know in Germany they've outlawed bleach, and it's supposed to be not very good for the environment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
It is possible to do the rearrangement and the chemistry without bleach. We viewed bleach as something that could be made in situ, inside the reaction mixture. And we were trying to do it like enclosed system, but we haven't investigated what other oxidants that would be cheap and economical and easy to make and work with.
So that, but there's possibilities out there for that.
Many possibilities. We limited our scope because we wanted to be cost effective. But if you're not worried as much about the cost and more about not using bleach or something,
it could it could well be done. So where are you in the process?
Right now, we are actually looking at making a startup company called Fennelvation, where we're looking at the economics of it and seeing where we could find sources of the material, how we can scale it up from being a benchtop system to something that's more realistic in production and making tons a year, if not hundreds of tons.
It's been really a lot of fun for me over the years, because I was hosting this show, I think, when the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center actually got started, which is a ways back now.
About 17 years.
17 years. And what's the potential for developing biofuels from non-food plant fiber?
I think it's very, very high potential, and it's becoming more and more essential for us to really pursue. We've identified a lot of new pathways. We're getting a lot of different directions from what we originally started off with, talking of the ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, moving to isobutanol, and now it's even moving farther into looking at other liquid fuels and transportation fuels.
Susan in Madison called, couldn't stay with us, but wonders if the acetaminophen from trees results in less liver toxicity.
So that would, the answer, short answer would be no, it wouldn't, because what we'd be producing is in essence the same purity of chemical, which is really high pharmaceutical grade purity. So all of the impacts of the acetaminophen would still be there on the liver and other parts of the body.
Steve Carlson, our guest today, as we talk about his research through the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Questions for him about this relationship between acetaminophen and poplar trees. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Steve Carlin today, staff scientist at UW-Madison's Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, looking at the work that he and others are doing to produce acetaminophen from poplar trees, and also looking at other potential uses for their research. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Mary in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm extremely allergic to Tylenol. The only time I ever took it, I ended up in the emergency room. I'm not allergic to aspirin. I'm wondering if this new way of making Tylenol would change my allergy or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. It's that's got to be tough. I do not think it would change your allergy at all, unfortunately. The difference would be chemically of what the structures are. And though the two are very similar, they are different enough that this wouldn't be able to help.
Oh, that's unfortunately the case, Mary. Thank you very much for calling, though. Are there any byproducts from the process of making the acetaminophen, and if so, what do they do with them? So, I mean, I guess how pure is the process?
So this has been a challenge that we actually had to face for quite a while. Our early attempts in the batch process, we were making basically black ink, and really 70% or more of ours was going to that. In our continuous process that we talked about, we are actually getting upwards of 90-95% conversion to the final product, paracetamol. And these side products are either the starting material or some mostly starting material. But then there's also, what did you use with your reagents? And that's why we chose bleach originally and making sodium chloride, table salt. And we're not worried about that. Some of the other parts in the line is going to be acetic acid, which is your vinegar. And so we were really conscious trying to pair up what we made as impurities for downstream purification and
So you're looking at 95%
of the material converted over to product.
Wow. Jim in Westby, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jim.
How you doing?
Great.
Simple. Maybe this has been covered because I tuned in late, but I'm wondering if they have done, if you guys have done, a carbon balance. Does this process release carbon to the atmosphere? That's the real question.
Yeah, or does it sequester?
So this process would release carbon to the atmosphere as a net process. We do not have in the purification and running it any way to trap or recover carbon from the atmosphere. However, we are trying to put this in together with a biomass processing facility and sourcing it from trees instead of from the coal tar or petrochemicals. So our starting material, it comes in a lot less carbon impact than what we would have been for the other routes.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Patrick emailed to ask, what's your guest thoughts? What are your thoughts on the increase in cancers, autism, as side effect of so many fossil fuels and chemicals ingested in our bodies through foods, clothing, medications, makeup, and so on?
I worry about that a lot. I know a lot of the petrochemicals can have a lot of products that can contain problems. Also, natural foods can also do the same thing. When you're a chemist, you start realizing that every chemical is healthy and unhealthy. The old adage of the dosage makes the medicine or the poison. And so.
Yeah. Mary Kay in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. I know popular is good for making musical instruments and firewood and things like that, but working with oregano is an antimicrobial, anti-cancer, anti-cough. I can think of many other things. You should start researching the herbs.
Thank you. I actually have looked at a few herbs and spices through my time and trying to look at the chemical composition of them and really looking for compounds that we could actually extract value out of. And they're really exciting.
Yeah, they are indeed. I'm wondering, I could imagine, or maybe do you imagine, people starting poplar tree farms specifically to extract the needed compound?
So the problem with the compound is it's a 1% of the weight of the biomass. And if you were to process the poplar tree farm just for that, you wouldn't be able to make the books. The economics wouldn't work. But poplar is great for paper making. It's great for lumber. Other type of applications. So you'd plant your plantation and then you'd make a portfolio of products. And that portfolio is really what we're after.
So you're essentially using businesses that are already in place and producing other products.
That's our dream, is to add to the portfolio what they're currently producing.
That sure makes a lot of sense. What's the potential economic impact of the process you've developed?
That's a tough question. Right now, the paracetamol market is about $130 million a year. And that's just the chemical, not the formulation you'd buy at the store, which takes it into the billions. So our impact could be millions to dollars impact, just economic on our own.
And we are, and I'm thinking about this here, we are a state that produces a lot of paper. And paper we write on, paper, toilet paper, all kinds of things. So I'm thinking a state like Wisconsin would have some real benefit from this.
That's what we think as well, especially up north of the state where I've been told poplar trees could grow fences in a year or two almost. They grow real fast.
Yeah, so some really good possibilities here. Josh emailed to ask, what are your thoughts on what the purpose this chemical might serve for the trees themselves?
That has been a big question that we've been asking ourselves, looking at how it actually gets into the tree and what it does. And we have every idea from it just helps the trees make the lignin, the part that holds it up and protects the water movements, everything else, to a Trojan horse where you get a white rot fungi eats it and it releases this toxic compound that kills the fungi. And so We're still investigating what is the reason for this to happen.
It, very interesting. Dennis emailed to say when scale economies are achieved, costs will decrease, and if it'll happen when popular demand increases. Incidentally, petroleum is partially a product of decayed trees. And he's right on that, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly. It's the where the petroleum came from, and looking at what is the economy of scale as this goes up and build the pipelines. That's one reason why we're looking at using current infrastructure and popular production and facilities. Maybe they can be the source of our precursors, our starting material.
John wonders, could it be a game changer from helping to mitigate climate change?
We hope so. As part of a portfolio of products that we can make a bioeconomy from renewable, sustainable sources that allow us to transition without much impact to the public, our need from petrochemical sources over to bio sources.
So it's pretty positive. I mean, what is your sort of your time scale on this now? You've got this process kind of down in a way. What are we looking for in terms of actually getting this into production or getting this into general use?
So right now we're working at trying to figure out which downstream users, who would be buying it, purchasing it, which pharmaceutical companies or manufacturers, as well as where can we get the renewably sourced parahydroxybenzoic acid or parahydroxybenzamide. Who can we partner with to get that source from poplar trees or some other feedstock?
Yeah, and you've established, I think you mentioned this, you have established a startup company. And what do you hope the company can do then?
So the startup company, Fennelvation, myself, Dr. John Enchenar, and Jason Copeland are coming together, and we're trying to realize this dream of making it into an actual production that we can then point on a shelf, say, that is the paracetamol that we made. And we're looking to move it forward. We're working with D2P, Discovery to Product, here at UW-Madison to help advance that startup initiative.
And I would guess that you're all probably also going to have to be working with some companies, paper-producing companies, for example.
That's what we're trying to find and identify, the companies that produce the make poplar-based paper. And then what are they doing? And we'd love to talk with them. And, you know, where can we have a conversation about what they need, what we have?
And go from there. So that this is all, you know, sort of in the works. You're hoping like next year at this time, are we going to be, have we made a lot more progress?
I hope so. I hope it can keep going faster and faster. It's amazing leaving the academic lab and going into a business world. This pace is much different.
and everything has to be approved, and obviously, and the pluses and minuses. Are there downsides? It's hard to imagine one, but
I mean, there's always some gives and takes. And so, what cost are we going to do? Right now, it's going to be economic. It's probably going to be a more expensive process than what's currently done. The supply chains are bigger and more diverse. So bringing it all together, so there's a lot of logistics that's really the challenge.
Well, I have to bring you back, Stephen, and talk about this as you go down the road with it. It's really fascinating research to me, and I know to our listeners as well, judging from all the calls. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Larry. Really appreciate it.
Stephen Carlin, a staff scientist at UW-Madison Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Great to have him with us, and great to have you listening in. And we've got a great team as well. Joel Patnod, Clara Neipert, our producers, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins, Lee Rayburn, our executive producers, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.